Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Podcast, episode
53. 53. That's Portuguese.
Another week, another podcast.
Yes, another week, another podcast.
Another week, another animal band.
Yeah. That's now Italy and Ireland.
They into both countries entirely banned?
I'm not like an expert on the topic. I have to read the articles more clearly, but it seems like yes. And Ireland's is banning them beginning January 1st. So to the end of the year, that's all they get to figure out a different place. And like this article was saying, maybe their mayor or the governor, whatever the person of Ireland is. Uh-huh. I sound really unintelligent right now, but he was saying that he knows that this is how a lot of people make their yearly living, but that people should be trying to find a new way to do that.
It makes me sort of wonder, like, what is the thing 50 years from now that people are going to look back on currently in shows that will get banned? Obviously, animals is sort of a different thing, but I wonder if maybe risk-taking, you know, they have the big airbag now for, like, the Wallenda high wire. Mm. They used to just do it over, you know, sawdust.
They still do it in some places with no airbag.
Yeah, I wonder what will be, you know, seem too antiquated to keep in this business, right? 50 years from now.
And then an interesting other angle of this topic is that people in the community that think that animals shouldn't be banned was like, well, then zoos should technically be in the realm of being banned, like animal shows at zoos.
Yeah.
Because, like, isn't, like, it's kind of the same thing in a way, but they're not traveling with the circuit. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a tricky subject. We've tackled it a couple times here on the podcast with a few of our guests.
Yes.
Both people who are pro and con animals in the circus, but it seems clearly that the world is moving away from animals in the circus.
Yeah, New York, and then they said that Scotland's probably soon to follow.
Mm.
So, New York, Ireland,
Illinois, California, many
Italy.
Other places, lots of those local areas, New Jersey, I think.
Yeah, for womp, all those womp. People. Womp womp. Oh well, you know, I don't know.
Times are changing.
We should go to Africa. We could all see elephants there.
Yeah, go on safari. Yeah, talk about elephants. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, we're not going to get into politics, but there's a whole other elephant thing going on right now.
But it's been a pretty slow news week, so our news coverage or topics to talk about are pretty limited. Minimal. But one thing, switching up a little bit, that's not circus, but still in the world of arts. I've been thinking a lot about this season of Broadway shows, mainly musicals that are opening.
The 2017-18 season?
Yes. And like four massive shows, one is not a musical, but could be, are all movie-based. So you have Harry Potter, which is opening in March, I think.
Sounds about right.
And it's a two-part show, so you have to buy tickets to two nights to see the whole show.
So if it gets nominated for a Tony, can they only nominate one, or can you nominate both jointly?
Oh my God, I don't know. Because you could, theoretically, right, it is two different plays. You have to buy tickets to two, but it's the same cast and same writer.
What if it would split the vote, or...
I bet you they'll say, and nominated for best play is Harry Potter and the Cursed Child parts 1 and 2.
Yeah.
You know, but
okay,
it's
so you
genius.
Got Harry Potter coming in.
So you got Harry Potter. You have Frozen.
Disney musical called Frozen.
You have SpongeBob, which is Nickelodeon. And you have Mean Girls when Tina Fey is writing the show.
I gotta say, I think out of all of those, I'm obviously excited to see Harry Potter, but I'm more excited to hear what the reception of Mean Girls is, because I feel like something like Bring It On, other things that are in that genre of musicals are either amazing or they tank. But I have a lot of faith in Tina Fey.
I did until I saw a photo of the four girls on stage, and it looks like, I don't know, I was like, oh man, like, even the aesthetic of the Mean Girls movie, it's not something like it's particularly nice to look at on stage. It reminds me of Legally Blonde. It reminded me of Bring It On, the musical. Like, all of that genre is not nice to look at on stage. Do you know what I mean?
Just because it's so pedestrian in the world?
Yeah, and it's like, in like the 2000s, and which isn't a particularly interesting style era.
No, but I think if you do have really funny comedian actresses, singers, and really good comedy, that might be the thing that separates it, the way Book of Mormon is separated by just how funny it is compared to other musicals.
Yes, but I would say Book of Mormon is even like, is so unrealistic
and stylized.
And stylized. Like the problem with Legally Blonde and Mean Girls and Bring It On. And
well, you haven't seen Mean Girls yet.
I haven't seen Mean Girls, but like, so something with those musicals is like, you know, who really wants to see a show about.
I do.
But it's like this weird like time period. I don't know.
I don't think people care about the time period. People like Mean Girls. They're going to go see. We'll see. The numbers will tell us. Thankfully, Broadway numbers are public, so we can tangibly see how well a show is doing.
Let's play a game.
All right. So which ones do we think will gross the best, or which one do you think will stay open the longest? What's the game?
The game is I guess we could do.
How about this for the bet?
Okay.
Which show closes first? Mean Girls, SpongeBob, and what's the other one?
Frozen.
So well, we can assume Frozen and Harry Potter just won't close.
Yeah, because it's Disney.
They got too much.
Okay, so let's put it down to SpongeBob and Mean Girls. That feels pretty fair.
Yeah.
However, SpongeBob is Nickelodeon, so they might have more of like money to spend.
I definitely there's a bigger universal love for SpongeBob than I think there is for.
And it's like Mean the Honeymooners, a TV show. Was it a TV show or a movie or something?
I don't know. Yeah, it sounds.
But
about
that's
right.
I think coming in too.
So, okay, so we're saying we think Mean Girls is... You're going to take Mean Girls or SpongeBob? I'll take the other one.
As to what?
Like, as which will close first.
Hmm. It's really hard. They feel very equal. SpongeBob.
Great. I'll take Mean Girls. Listeners, send us your thoughts. Tweet them at us.
Well, will you want to know why I picked SpongeBob?
Yeah, sure.
Because I think the carrying costs of SpongeBob are probably higher.
But Viacom's got a bigger, you know, budget.
Yeah, but how much... You know, how much do you lose before it's like...
You know, I said the same thing, but Cirque du Soleil ran Paramore for a year with losses and then got a 20 grand buyout, so...
Yeah, no, 20 million.
Sorry, 20 million.
Yeah, but that doesn't happen every day. But Mean Girls, I think, is probably a smaller show, and I think it's a smaller house, too, so it's less...
Pressure,
in a way.
I also feel like critics are more likely to give awards, even if SpongeBob is amazing, to things that aren't owned by big networks.
Yeah, like, I bet you Frozen will get, like, a set design award or costumes.
Even if it's lighting. The best musical of the year.
It won't get nominated.
Yeah.
But that's... It'll never get nominated, maybe, but... For best musical, I don't think so.
Really?
I don't think so.
So who do you think is going to win best musical?
The Band's Visit. I'm, like, banking on The Band's Visit. It's so good. And it's, like, this small little musical where nothing happens. You know, it's, like, a night in these people's lives. And it's, like, the most beautiful... Like, touching, not overthought, not overpushing musical I've seen in so long.
Mm. Well, that was our little Broadway roundup of 2017-18.
Yeah.
Let us know your thoughts.
Well, and if another musical comes in that's based on a movie, we can add it to the game.
The game? Okay,
yeah,
great.
But it can't obviously be, like, a Frozen or a Harry Potter, which we know will just, like, sell a buttload of tickets and stay open. Okay. That's our game.
That's the game. SpongeBob v. Mean Girls.
SpongeBob v. Mean Girls. Well, I'm really excited for this podcast today. We have Elaine Kramer on as our interviewee. And I think I was just like, I could have listened to her tell stories about her life for another hour.
So I met Elaine originally at the Box when we were both maybe 17 and 18. She is a 8th generation circus performer. Her family, I believe, is Argentinian. At least one side of it is originally, then Mexican, and then American. And she's performed all over the world. She's competed and won at Monte Carlo. Elaine does this amazing handstand contortion number. Truly.
That ends with a bow and arrow that she shoots with her feet to a target, like 20 feet away.
It's really impressive. It's for sure one of my favorite handstand acts. I loved it so much I cast it in Rose Rabbit Lie, the show I worked on in Las Vegas with Spiegelworld. And then, of course, she's in Big Apple this year, and she was in Big Apple about 5 years ago as well. So we talk about Big Apple, what's going on with it, what's the difference between the old and the new one, sort of similar kind of discussion we had with Mark. But we also talk about what it's like to be a multi-generational circus performer, growing up in a circus family, how you learn such a discipline when you're not doing it through school, but when your dad is teaching it to you. Mm-hmm. Just a really interesting perspective, particularly for those who are interested in the more traditional classical circus.
Yes. And it's just so different than anything that I, you know, I had no friends in the circus. So it's like, wait, you grew up traveling around in a trailer with your family and you learned to contort your body at four. So I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. And if you like our podcast, make sure to rate us on iTunes, subscribe on iTunes, follow us on Instagram, like us on Facebook, Twitter tweet us, email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. And for those of you who are American or are in America celebrating Thanksgiving, happy Thanksgiving. Here's Elaine.
Elaine, where did you grow up?
I grew up most of what I remember is in the States. I was born in Mexico, in Guadalajara, but my parents left Mexico and went back to Argentina when I was two. So I was in Argentina until I was seven, and then we came to the States.
And are your parents circus performers?
Yes, both of my parents are circus performers. I'm a sixth generation on my dad's side and about an eighth generation on my mom's side.
Did you think that was cool as a kid? Did you realize that was unusual at all?
I didn't realize it was unusual. I mean, my whole family was in circus. My friends were in circus. You know, everyone I knew was in circus. So for me, it was like a normal thing to just be in the circus business.
Did they do that thing where you're like a baby and they balance you?
Yeah, they balance
you. I was like, Josh, we have kids. We are doing that. We're balancing them.
My mom actually there's a picture of her because she used to do trapeze. So there's a picture of her holding me on a trapeze and I'm like gripping on and I was just a baby. Like I wasn't even a year old and I was like gripping onto the trapeze. So yeah, there's a whole bunch of those pictures. Oh my gosh.
So your mom did trapeze and what did your dad do?
My mom was an aerialist overall. Oh. So she did, she started off with a robat. So she did aerial rope, and then she moved on to doing hair hang, which is the act that she did the longest. She also did trapeze and lyra. And my father was an acrobat. So he did – they grew up in a really small family circus, so every year they had to, like, think of new acts and do different things with all of his cousins and brothers. So he did a lot of acts in the circus, including teeter board and horseback riding. And he did wire and slack rope was the act that he did after he left the circus. And he was with my mom. So he did slack rope.
And he's still clowning now, right?
And now he converted into a clown. He says it's much easier on his body. So,
what show is he in now?
He's in Circuitalia.
Oh,
is that the water show?
It's with the dancing water stage. And yeah, it's really
sweet.
Cool.
And you have a brother as well, right?
I have a younger brother. He's also a performer. He does a hand balancing act. And he's like kind of multi-talented. So besides his hand balancing act, which is his main act, he also does like rollbola and juggling and a whole bunch of other stuff. And he's working in Vargas, Circus Vargas, with my family over there.
So well, you're like a young kid at some point, you're 10, 11, and you're starting to realize that like not everybody maybe is like you. Did you just know that you wanted to do circus? Did you have any point of, like, rebellion in your teenage years?
I've always liked as a child, I've always liked being the center of attention. So, like, at parties, I'd do, like, backbends or walkovers or something. I loved performing. My parents put me in their bicycle act at a really young age. I was only, like, three. When I started, my mom would dress me up like her, and I'd just be dancing in the background, basically. And I loved that. I loved being in the ring and having people cheer and, you know, making people laugh. So, yeah, I know that this is what I wanted to do. And if I wasn't in circus, they always ask me this question, like, what would you do? I said, I probably would be in the entertainment business, like an actress or maybe a dancer because I like working with my body as well. So I would do something of the sort.
And so I'd say you're famous for your handstand act. How did that sort of come to be? Like, who taught it to you? I'm guessing it was your parents, but what was that process like?
Okay, so when I was 4 years old, my parents were working in a circus in Mexico when they went back to do a tour. And I met a girl who was a contortionist. And I loved her act, and I would watch it, like, every day. She didn't do any hand balancing, but she... Because back then it was like two separate acts. Now it's more of a, you know, it's more common to see combined contortion and hand balancing. But she was a beautiful contortionist and I loved her act. And my dad was like, well, if you want to start doing that, we have to start training. And I was like, yeah, sure. So I would like stretch with her and then always have my dad there with me. And then when we left the circus, I continued, you know, wanting to be like her. And so I started my actual like everyday training with my father around the age of 8. Where he was like, okay, you need to either go to school, like stay in school with your mom, or you continue doing homeschool, but you gotta, if you're gonna stay in the circus, you gotta, you know, do something. And I was like, well, I want to stay in the circus. So, so I just started practicing with my dad. As the years went by, of course, I would train sometimes with Russians when we were in a show with like Russians, hand balancers, Mongolian. I had a Mongolian teacher at one point as well. For the contortion, a Cuban hand balancer. So I don't really have a technique from one, how do you say it? Like from one school. Yeah, it's kind of just like whatever. That's cool. Anything that came along, any tips that would help me, I would take it and put it into my training.
So did you also know like a lot of other teenagers who were in a similar position to you who were, you know, multi-generation and in these shows and learning acts?
Yeah, I mean, I've always had some kind of, you know, teenagers or kids in the shows where I was in. There was always families. And it was always nice to have that because everyone's always training something. And when you have other kids your age, it's sort of like it makes it fun to train and it makes it sort of like a competition, like, ooh, I can do this. Oh, but I can do that, you know?
I can get my leg all the way around my entire body.
So it becomes sort of like a game during practice time, which is much more fun than if you're just by yourself, you know, with your trainer and just have to cover that 2 or 3 hours of training. That didn't seem, it was also like going to school for me, you know? I mean, for me, the most boring thing was doing homeschool because then I was by myself. I couldn't have any distractions, you know? But practicing was always a lot of fun.
What was the first show that you had like your first solo act in?
My first time actually performing the contortion act was at age 7, but that it was just like a thing we put together because it was my dad's birthday. So my mom made me like a costume in like a day and it was all a secret and everybody helped. And yeah, and so that was my first time doing the contortion act, but it wasn't like professional until when I was around, I would say 11. Then I started really working hard and just working every day. And at age 12, I went to my first circus competition.
Where was the competition?
That was in Latina, Italy. And it came out really good because, you know, being my first competition, I didn't really think about winning or, you know, I just wanted to be there. I was happy to be there. And I came out second place. So that was actually really good. And then it just kind of pushed me forward to doing more and getting to travel more with my act and everything. So
was there a company?
I'm just thinking about 12. Like, this is all just like so crazy to me. Like, yeah, well, I was like 11, 12. I did my first competition, got second.
Yeah.
But I'm like, so what was like a typical day for you? So you do like training and then homeschool. And this whole time, where are you living? Like, are you in a show, in a trailer, or like, this whole life is so cool. So I want like a day in the life. At like 11.
At 11. So I had to wake up early. I would practice first. Then I would have kind of like a late breakfast. Homeschool. And after that, I would probably have lunch, and then I would just hang out with my brother or my friends. We'd go to the movies or watch a movie at home, or I don't know, play outside depending on the weather and where we were at the time, because we were traveling almost every day. We were in a traveling circus, so I was living in a trailer with my mom, my dad, and my brother.
Do you feel like you have roots down anywhere like that you would call you home like maybe Sarasota. I don't know. I'm guessing Sarasota or somewhere like that, or Vegas.
We do have a house. We have a house near Orlando. It's the town is called Palm Bay, Florida, and that's where I live. But it doesn't feel. It's so weird. It doesn't really feel like home. Like I miss it. And I, when I'm there, I enjoy the first like week or so, but then it's like the second, the third week, it's like, okay, I need to get out. I need to do something. So yeah, it's weird. Like I would feel more comfortable in a hotel or in a trailer or it's
on the road.
Yeah. Just traveling.
So I think we first met at the Box as, like, teenagers who probably shouldn't have been there at that age.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, my first time performing at the Box was I had just turned 18, so I wasn't allowed to actually be in there, but I would perform, and then, like, kind of, they were like, okay, you gotta go now. I'd just come in, do my act, and then have to leave. That was probably the first time we met. It was quite a while ago.
How did you hear about the Box? Like, from what happened between age 12 and 18?
More shows, I guess.
So, more shows, yes. I also did another circus festival in Mexico. I did the circus festival junior competition in Monte Carlo. And then I did the adult competition in Monte Carlo when I was 15, which was... I think to this day, I'm still the youngest female solo performer that has ever performed in the Monte Carlo adult competition.
Nice. Would you describe what Monte Carlo the competition is like, and what kind of acts are in it for somebody who knows very little, maybe is like a student at a circus school or something?
So Monte Carlo, in Monte Carlo, they hold a yearly circus competition, which is, to put it in perspective, is like the Grammys. Mm-hmm. You know, for circus performers, it's the biggest thing. And luckily at the time, I didn't really know how important it was, because I think I just would have been super nervous. I mean, I was already nervous, but just now picturing it, like if I would have known, I don't know if I could have done it. I was supposed to go 2 years before. And I couldn't go because I was making my green card, so I couldn't leave the country for that time. So we postponed it to the year after, and then it was the 30th anniversary of Monte Carlo. So then I couldn't go either because they wanted me to go but not to compete. And my dad was like, I'd prefer you to be in the competition because you're going to be with a whole bunch of acts that have already been there and have already won. And you're just kind of not going to be, people aren't going to be remembered. Yeah.
Right.
You're not going to be remembered or anything. So
good dadager.
Yeah.
Dadager. Well, it's not momager. Dadager.
So we waited another year. And then when I arrived to Monte Carlo, unfortunately my props didn't.
And so props being like your handstand table, your cane.
Yeah, I had like three luggages that were props, and then one personal luggage, which did arrive. And so the table is split up between the table, the bow and arrow, the handstand prop.
I was like, she does a crossbow. Yeah. It's a bow and arrow. Yeah. I remember seeing a bow and arrow.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, everyone gets that. Yeah, it tells me that, oh, do you do a crossbow? I'm like, no. That would be very hard.
Yeah, I was like, how should you get
the toe?
Like,
yeah. Oh, that would be hard. The bow and arrow is not so hard, but a crossbow, that would be hard.
I was literally this whole time like, wait, how the fuck does she do?
For those who are listening, Elaine does a handstand at the end of her, throughout her number, but at the end with a bow and arrow in her toes, and then pops a balloon that's like, I don't know, 20 feet away, 30 feet away.
Yeah, I don't know how far it is here. It's a bit closer here.
Yeah.
At the Box, I do it at like really
like
short distance.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's actually, the stage is 4 feet. So I do it about four feet. Yeah. And it's really small. So yeah, it always changes depending on where I am.
So not all your props arrived.
So not all my props arrived. And we had about a week and a half of rehearsals. So all the whole rehearsals, like people were, you know, getting used to the ring, getting used to the lights, you know, testing music and all that. And I'm just sitting there waiting for the airport to be like, your stuff arrived. The worst part is I would call the airport and they would be like, oh, we don't actually know where it is. And I'm like, how do you not know where it is? Like, it's either in France or it's in America. Like, right. Where else is going to be? So I was already like, okay, well, I'm not going to be able to perform. Like, there's 2 days of competition worth of acts because there's so many performers and so many acts. There's just not possible to fit it in one show. So they divide it into groups. So there's group A and group B. I was originally supposed to be in group A, which is the first show. And they had to move me to group B because they knew that tomorrow I was not going to be able to perform. So my dad wakes up that day and he's like, well, we're going to go make a prop. We're going to make a table. Because the only thing I had was I had my canes and I had my bow and arrow and my mouthpiece, but I didn't have the table. It's like, we're going to make a table. I'm like, you're crazy, Dad. So we actually found a place that made it in 24 hours. The only reason why they made it was because of the festival. So they made the table. It arrives the day that I'm supposed to perform, which is already the second day of work. And they move me from the first half to the second half of the show because there was just no way I could make it. The table arrives 15 minutes before doors. I was the only one allowed in the ring just to test lights for 15 minutes, take the table out, and the whole first half of the show, I'm getting used to the table. And we realize that the table tilts over when I step on the ends because my table is made of 3 legs. So every end would tilt over because the legs were completely straight rather than kind of having an angle. And we didn't think of that when, you know, right, we were just like, just make a table. Right. So I had a really limited space to move around in the table. And also my dad had broken his femur before flying. So he had a hard time walking. And he would always walk with a cane. But, of course, when we had to do the show, he'd just, like, suck it up and just go in and do it.
That's a circus performer for you. Yeah. Like, I'm not going Monte Carlo. I'm out.
It's like, no, I'm going and I don't need a cane. And he hands me the bow and arrow to my feet. So when he hands it to me, he has to be at a certain height because otherwise I don't reach it. Well, we didn't realize that the table was also much taller than it normally is, so he didn't reach, especially with his hip hurting every time he would, you know, like stretch up. So I would have to bend down, pick the bow and arrow up, and then come all the way back up and then aim. So that was interesting. We had a whole week worth of shows and, you know, the whole competition. And then after the competition, we have a week worth of shows. So it's like 2 weeks. The table never arrived until like the very last, I think there was like 3 days left of shows. Oh. This was after the competition and everything. Oh, in the competition, it actually came out really good. I came out third in the competition. So... yeah, that was a very stressful time.
I guess worth it, though.
It was worth it, yes. And then the table came, like, the 3 last days. And I was like, I'm not setting that up. I'm done.
I'm just using this wonky table.
Yeah. So, but it was a really great experience and really fun. I would not be able to do it right now if I, like, knowing, like I said, knowing how important that competition was and everything, I probably wouldn't be able to do it nowadays. I feel like younger, I didn't have any stress or any, right. I didn't think things through. Like, I was just like, oh, okay.
You're more ignorant when you're younger, so you're more blissful about everything.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And then you don't realize till later when you're like, oh, this is really important. I need to really do well.
Yeah.
When you're young, you're like, who cares?
Yeah.
I got this.
Let's do it. Yeah.
So how did you learn to shoot a crossbow with your... No, sorry. Oh, my God. Now you got me doing
bow and arrow
with your feet upside down.
How did I do that? Okay.
I was like, I want to do this. I'm going to learn how to do this.
So the story goes way back. I was not even born when this trick came to be. My father was performing in the islands of Samoa, Western Samoa. He was touring around with the circus. And in one of the islands, he goes into a restaurant that has like pictures of people on the walls, like famous people or people that were interesting that came to the restaurant. And my dad was always fascinated by, like, you know, singers and just entertainment business in general. There's like a lot of comedians that were on the walls. And one of those pictures was a woman. The pictures was taken on the year 61. And the woman is holding a handmade bow with her feet, and a handmade arrow is inside of it, and she's holding it with her feet while on her like in the mouthpiece position. So it's that's like one of the first tricks that I do in my act. And so she's on that position with holding this bow and arrow. We don't know if she was aiming at a target or it was just part of the trick, mm-hmm. or we don't know exactly, but it's a beautiful picture, which I also have a copy of, because my dad asked for a copy when we were there. He was like, oh, this is great. Like, he was like, yeah, this is a circus that came a couple years ago. And my father actually took this picture and put it on our wall. And so my dad was like fascinated by the story and the trick and everything. We'd never seen anything like it. Him and my mom, because I wasn't even there yet. And so he asked for a copy of the photo. He kept the photo all these years. And then my father was like saying to my mom, if we have a girl, she's gonna learn this trick. And my mom's like, okay, you're crazy. Here you go again. And then when I was 7, he already knew that I liked contortion and I already was into this. So he showed me this picture and he's like, you want to try this? And I was like, all right, let's see what happens. And we actually bought a bow and arrow and we started trying it. And it was not very good the first 2 years. And then we actually got it up and running and we put it into the act.
Well, so you started learning it when you were 7?
I started learning this trick when I was 7.
Year old. Yeah. I can shoot a bow and arrow with my feet. And so the bow and arrow that you use, is it specially made for you, or is it just
No, it's just a bow. How do you call it? With the wheel bearings. It's just a regular, like, bow that you buy in a store. I have to get it at a certain weight because I have another bow that I bought recently and it just doesn't work because it's way too heavy and it makes my back hurt. Oh. So I tried to get lightweight bows, but also, you know, good enough that it's for adults and not for children. Mm-hmm. So the string can actually pull back and I have a much more precise shot. So,
you've worked on like a lot of different kinds of shows. I know this from hearing you talk about the traditional shows and also the shows we've worked on together. At the Spiegel World show in Las Vegas and Fox. What is it like adapting your acts? I imagine everywhere you go, people are like, okay, here's a new costume and here's a new song and like maybe here's a little bit of choreography. But essentially you're doing like the same core elements. Can you just talk a little bit about like what that's like having to constantly change it up a little bit, if it's fun, if it's challenging, maybe like one or two stories where it was like maybe really bad, the choices people wanted you to have are good.
So there's always going to be, I think, some sort of disagreement when you go to a show that chooses your music, your costume, or changes your routine. Because I feel that as a performer, you kind of are proud of what you do and you're like, yeah, I chose this music. Yeah, I chose the routine and I designed my costume. In a way, you kind of like you feel pride and you don't really want, you know, especially if you don't like it. Like if you don't like the music, you're just like, well, I can't work to this for a year. Right? Yeah. And if it's like a short time, like I work in a lot of nightclubs where a lot of times you just work to whatever the DJ is playing at the time, which a lot of times is good. And a lot of times it's like, oh, my goodness, I can't wait till this is finished. So, it's the same beat on and on.
Like, this isn't really helping with my bending moment.
because as a performer, you want to enjoy what you're doing. You know, you want to feel comfortable in what you're wearing. You want to love the music so you really get into it. The routine matters a lot because it just gets you in the zone to, depending on what character you're playing, because I find that I play along with whatever the music is and whatever my costume is. I try to make a character to it and kind of play along with it. It helps me just have fun and like
motivates the performance.
Yes. Thank you. That was a perfect explanation. So there's always going to be some sort of conflict. When I was performing with Vegas Nocturne at the Rose Rabbit Lie Theater in Vegas, the director was great. The good thing is I don't think I've had one director that hasn't been understanding. So far it's been good. Like, I explained to them, like, I can't do this, or we need to change the music, or we need to figure out a way that my costume actually stretches.
I remember the Rose Rabbit Lie song you had. It was such a crazy.
Oh yeah, Josh was trying to remember it on the subway.
I had two.
Two, yeah.
Because the show there was very...
Now you won twice, right?
Well, actually, three times. It was three... For me, it was basically three shows. Two actual performances, and one was just kind of like a show and tell for the people in the other room. It was a very odd show. Like, it was very, like, you had the ballroom where people pay the ticket to watch a show, and then behind the ballroom, it was, like, the dinner area, so people are having dinner, and some acts are just performing or coming out of performing and just kind of playing characters. And then you have another room, which is, like, a secret room where just only VIP people get picked to go there, and then you put on a little sneak peek of what you do in the show. So there's, like, I performed in all three of these. So the first show we had in the ballroom, it was very, like, very slow music, and I had a singer.
Chrissy, right?
Yeah, Chrissy was singing during my act, which was very beautiful. I loved
having...
Do you
remember the song?
So weird. It's like animal. Is that the one that has to do with
animal? Yeah, it's animal. I can't remember it.
It was such a weird track.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. But I tried to just listen it.
Yeah.
Chrissy's voice.
Yeah, she's amazing. She's an amazing singer.
Yeah, she's amazing. And I loved the fact that because I'm so used to working on my own, like doing just my own thing. It was really nice to feel like, oh, it was like a duet almost, like a two-person thing. It was really fun. And then the evening show, in that first one, I wore kind of like a skin-colored leotard with like white tattoos everywhere, like words, you know, different like inspirational like words, and then like kind of a white corset over it. And then in the evening show,
you wear a corset?
No, it was not. There was no like.
There was no boning.
No
in it.
Boning.
Oh. I was like, how the hell are you?
Ow! Ow! And then I did the evening show, which was the was the nightclub. So that was like I wore like a black kind of costume, and the mood. Yeah, the mood was like there was like nightclub lights, and the music was much more upbeat. And then in the other room, it was just sort of whatever elevator music was playing in the room. So yeah, that was really fun. And the costumes for that show, I loved both the costumes.
Yeah, that guy's awesome. He did the Moulin Rouge costumes.
Yes,
the movie, not the show.
Yeah. They were really good. They fit really well. And actually, the guy who made those costumes actually made my costume for Big Apple this year.
Oh.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it was the designer, but it was definitely the seamstress that made it. Yeah, he's great.
That's a good transition. Would you talk a little bit about the difference between the first time you did Big Apple when it was a nonprofit 5 years ago and doing it now at the revamped, relaunched Big Apple?
As a performer, I don't notice much of a difference. I mean, we still have the band playing a track. We still have, you know, costumes that were made for the show. The biggest difference in the show is that there's not an actual theme more than just, you know, performers doing their thing, you know. I really do enjoy that I'm performing with my own music that I normally use all the time. The band is playing that, and I'm really happy about that because I love the way the band plays it, and they're making it a little bit more. I work to an opera music, so they're making it a bit more like rock and roll style. So it's really fun to work to that. And I don't know, the cast is great in the show. Like I'm really happy. It was also great 5 years ago. But this year, it just everybody just sort of clicked the first couple of days that we were in rehearsals and everything.
As a performer, do you like having a theme or like a reason?
Just gonna ask that.
A reason for being in this show, or do you like it just being like this? There's no theme. There's no like meaning. It's just about the acts.
Like I said, I always in my act, I always try to play something or just play along with some sort of thing. So I do like having a theme. Like 5 years ago when I was in the show, it was the Legendarium. So I played a part of a Native American, hence the bow and arrow and the body tattoos on the on the costume. And I really loved it. I loved playing that part. I wasn't so crazy about the music in the beginning and the costume, but we made it work, and then the costume turned out to be great. The music turned out to be really good too. It's just a matter of working with other people to make it what you feel comfortable with. But yeah, that show was really fun. I loved playing, playing a part that was kind of part of history, especially in the New York area.
Especially if you like acting, if that's something that could have inspired you as a performer, you know, it's fun to be like, this is my role in this show and not just like come out and do your thing. But I have to say, when I saw your act, I did feel like it was a character, like I was watching like someone doing this thing and not just like, I think sometimes more traditional looking performers come out and they're like, I'm doing these tricks, I'm doing this act, and they're amazing.
It's just very athletic.
It's really, but yeah, it's like really like athletic and impressive. But what I liked about your act a lot was that I felt like there was something going on in the act, even though your tricks are like insane and like really impressive.
Yeah.
But I did get that.
I get this a lot from people. Like they're like, oh, are you? Did you see me in the audience? Like I was, like sometimes it's friends or just people that come to watch the show. They're like, oh, like my daughter was like doing, all the hand movements. Did you see her? And I was like, no. It's like, oh, but you were looking right at us. And I'm like,
I can't.
No.
Lights are really bright.
Yeah. I don't think people understand. Like they can see me very well, but away from what the light is, like I can't see past that. Right. Like I can't see even the first row. It's really hard for me to see people's faces, but I feel that I get that a lot because I don't know if there's people sitting there a lot of times, like it's in the back seats and there's nobody sitting there, but I just kind of imagine people there, and I kind of imagine looking into their eyes and just smiling at them, and people buy it that I'm actually looking at them or I saw them, this guy with the camera the other day, he brought me a pictures because he came like a couple shows back. He's like, oh, that's perfect. Like, I'm glad you got to see the camera because I got perfect shots of you looking straight into the camera. And I was like, oh, I didn't know you were there. So.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
So this is a random question, but right now your hair is dyed blue. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm wondering
teal.
If that makes
Thank you for saying, teal. Blue and teal, because a lot of people say green, and I'm like, it's not green.
No, it's like the best.
Yeah. It's like mermaid color.
And I also know that people who do hair hanging acts are like very particular about not damaging their hair.
Yeah.
So was your mom like, what are you doing? You can't do hair hanging anymore.
My mom actually never wanted me to do hair hang. I've always wanted to do hair hang, and she was always like, no.
Why not? Is it painful? Or?
She's like, yeah, it's very painful. I'm like, Mom, I'm a contortionist. Right. So I know about pain. But yeah, she was always like, yeah, it's hard because like in the winter you have to wet your hair to, get it to work like that. Like a lot of times she would have to keep her hair dirty and then just wash it on the first day off. And then kind of if it was too clean to, to tie her hair on the days that she would work, she'd have to use like soap and just kind of make it dirty and dry. And And she's like, yeah, it just damages your hair a lot. And then there's also, of course, if you don't know how to do the correct knots in your hair, then you can get like sort of blood clots. And if you get them, my mom always got them outside, thankfully. But if you get them inside, you won't know. And then it's very dangerous. So a lot of things like that. And she was just like, yeah, it's just
not worth it.
It's not worth it. I think hair hang is beautiful. Like, I love the act. And it's sort of a lost art right now.
But it's coming back, I think. I've seen a few people.
Yeah, I hope so. Because it's very beautiful. And I really like it. It's really crazy.
The first time I saw it, I was like, wait, are they hanging on? Wait, is that their hair?
But my first time seeing hair hanging, I'd only seen it like in a Fell show where it's basically just like, you get pulled up straight and then you spin and you come back down. But I recently saw the video footage from, what's the new Cirque show? Volta has a hair hanging out, and a girl is swinging with her hair. Yeah. It's much more impressive when you see people do it, like what you might do with straps or something, where you get lifted and you're spinning and you're in the air. And...
Well, speaking of like pain, how did you learn how to support your entire body contorted upside down on your teeth?
And does that hurt your teeth?
And are you
Did your
like,
dentist say, what do you do?
It doesn't hurt my teeth. No, it actually fixed my teeth a lot because I bite onto this, like, it's sort of like a leather piece that you bite onto. And then the front of it is also, like, sticking out. So then your teeth don't pass the point of, you know, if I weren't to, like, grip on, then, you know, I'm not gonna inhale the pole. So it actually fixed my teeth a lot because that, you know, like, pressed my teeth in. And it's not very painful on the teeth. It's when I was learning it, it was very painful on my tailbone and the top of my head, because the tailbone would touch the top of my head and then I would get like a callus.
That's so insane that your tailbone touches the top.
I was like, oh, yeah. So on the teeth, it wasn't that. And I'm not actually biting as hard as people think I am.
Yeah, it's more like resting on
It's more like resting because my weight is like on top of my head. So I just have to just
stay
hold
there.
It. Yeah. Yeah. And it's not. It's very different from hanging. Erendira Walenda, which is Nick Walenda's wife, she actually hangs.
Yeah.
By her teeth, and we were just talking about it the other day because, you know, we use our teeth for tricks. So we were talking about, like, the techniques, and it's very different, actually, one from the other. Like, she actually needs to bite on it, otherwise she'll slip.
Right.
Yeah.
What's her mouthpiece look like?
Like a ball?
Hers actually has a curved at the inside, so she can... You know, she has more grip when she bites into it. Mm. And mine's, like, kind of flat and then just has the thing in the front. So, yeah, we were just having mouthpiece talk between performers.
Normal conversation.
Are there any shows that you have on your bucket list you haven't done yet, or competitions where you're like, at some point in my career, I'm definitely going to have to do that, or I want to do that?
So I'm 25 now. I'm going to be 26 in February, and I'm just done with competitions. Yeah. I don't really want to do anymore. I did one in the beginning of this year in January in Switzerland, and that was... It just kind of came to be because the guy was just really excited. I'd never been to Switzerland, so I was like, okay, I want to go. And it was a very chill competition. It wasn't like, you know, it was almost just like a show that we did, you know, and then at the end they were like, oh, we're going to hand out prizes. You know, it wasn't stressful in any way. So that was fun. But I don't really want to do any more competitions. I think I already am a very nervous person when I'm going to work just in a regular show. So, like, going to a competition right now.
Amps that up.
Yeah, just would be too much for me. And
it's funny that you got nervous because I would think that since you've been performing since you were, like, 4, it must just feel like this is what you do.
So here's the funny thing. I find that when people already know who you are, they expect... from you, and I really feel that. Like, I perform a lot in Europe for the Christmas time, so I go to, like, Christmas shows, and the thing is that people in Europe, just in general, people that go to watch shows, like, they don't actually have to be performers or anything, but they know what they're going to go watch. Like, mm-hmm. they know they're performers. They know, they research on the people, like they see the program and they already read the names and, you know, Google them, and they already know what they're going to watch.
Yeah.
So it's very different from here, where it's sort of a surprise, you know?
Like, wait, what's that?
Yeah.
What's contortion? Yeah.
It's a surprise, but you're one of the featured names in the Big Apple ad.
So, yeah, but that's the thing. A lot of people actually remember me from 5 years ago when I was in Big Apple. So it's a different thing when you're, when you know that people are expecting from you.
Yeah.
Where it's just, you know, when you just go to a place that you've never been before, people have no idea who you are. You're just kind of like doing your thing. And if it goes well, it goes well. If not, it's okay. Nobody, you know, I'll have another show. Yeah. Have another show tomorrow. But yeah, it's a different feeling. I think that's what I feel now. Even a lot of times, like, people will say my name. I don't really realize how much people know of me. Like, when I went to Argentina now, before starting with Big Apple, I went back to Argentina after 6 years of not going there. I went and I performed there. And some girls that were starting contortion and stuff, they would come up to me, and one of them actually started crying, and I was like, why are you crying? She's like, oh, it was always my dream to meet you. And it's this, like, you know, 12-year-old girl, and she's, I'm like, wow, it's beautiful to inspire people, but at the same time, it's like, I can't lack off, you know?
Yeah. Like, oh God, people are really watching me.
Yeah, people are actually watching me, and yeah, it's just, I think that's why I just don't want to do any more competitions or anything. I just want to...
What about shows? Is there a circus company
shows,
that you're just like...
I did Roncalli last year for Christmas.
The German tented show, for those
The German show. I did their theater show because it was in Christmas. Mm. They have two shows in Christmas. They have their tent show, and then they have a show in a theater in Berlin. And I did the Berlin theater show. It was very beautiful, and it was... It's always been one of my dreams to work in Roncalli, but, you know, the touring tent show. Roncalli, for circus people, is like Disneyland. It's it's very beautiful, and it's sort of spotless, and it's got all these beautiful vintage circus wagons.
It's nearly like 100 years old, right?
Yeah, it's very, like, the tent is really small, and it's very intimate, and it's just for... A solo performer, especially, I think it's very important to have that intimacy and that, you know, kind of, you get to see people's faces when you're performing, and so that's always
but
been a dream
of mine.
But
the Big Apple tent, you're like 20 feet away.
Yeah, well,
from the first row.
Yeah, it's actually really nice to work in Big Apple too, and it was really nice to come back, because when you're also when you work in theaters and stuff, it's just so big, and it, you feel so disconnected from the audience that it's still a nice feeling, but I'd prefer, we're working for the audience, and we want to know what, you know, we want to express what we're feeling. So when you get to work so close, it's much more intense, you know, for the experience of the audience and for your experience as well.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. So Roncalli, anything else on the bucket list?
I would also like to work in Soleil, but I think that would probably towards the end of my career. I've done events for them. I've been called many times to do their shows, but it either
hasn't been the right circumstances.
Yeah, it hasn't been the right time, or, you know.
They typically do a lot of, like, group contortion, right? So...
But they have, like, solo handstands.
Yeah, I was...
I guess, yeah,
do
handstand.
Do some water bowl.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was called to do the part that Olga Pichenkov, which is one of my top favorite hand-bouncing performers.
She was in Kidam, right?
She was in Kidam. That was her first, I believe, Soleil, and then she did Varikai. So I was called for Kidam a long time ago. And then a couple of years back, I was called to do Varikai. But I had just signed.
Yeah, you gotta do the original creation.
And that's what I want to do. I would like to do an original creation, because then I get to do more of what I do and not have to, you know,
go into someone's role.
Go into someone's role. Just because it's hard for me. Like, a lot of people think, like, oh, hand balancing, it's all the same, or contortion, it's all the same. But everyone has their style and their different ways of doing, you know, things. And it would be very hard for me to play. I mean, it would be hard for anybody to play a different, you know, role that is already existing. But I don't know. I think it would be much funner to be in a new creation. And more rewarding. Yeah.
Awesome. So I think we've reached that time on a podcast where we ask each of our guests the same three final questions.
Okay.
The first one is, has there been a piece of advice, really good or really bad, that somebody has given you and has stuck with you?
I don't see advices as bad advices. Like, I think that people give their opinions and you either take it or leave it. And, you know, it works for some people, for other people it doesn't. Good advices. So there's a hand balancer, which is a Cuban friend of my family's, and he's worked in Soleil and many other shows, Rocardi. And he was one of my trainers at one point. And he did tell me, which it kind of stuck with me because I was still a kid, still learning, and he was a big inspiration in my work too. So he said to me, he's like, even when you think you have reached your potential or when you think you're happy with what you're doing, you should never feel that. He said, you should always try to aim for higher and always try to practice more. He says, that's what's going to keep you young inside as well as the outside. And that's what's going to inspire people as well. He says, when you feel too comfortable with what you're doing, it's like people can see that from the outside and it shows in your work. So I try to put that into my work all the time.
That's a great piece of advice. A second question is, we have a lot of people who listen who are on the younger age of the spectrum as well. Mm-hmm. And for somebody who's just realizing they love circus, is there a show or a book or a movie or just any circus reference that you love and you'd recommend that they try to experience too?
Depending on what they're working on, I think, I don't know, about books, it's all just about, you know, reading. A lot of times it's people's lives or, you know, just history of circus. I think you have to find what inspires you to be in the circus or to, you know, to have this way of life. For me, it was just, I loved watching videos of, especially like old videos of performers. So when I was growing up, I had like, my dad had a whole bunch of collection of VHS tapes from different shows, and I just loved sitting there and watching them. I think it's very important that you have either a trainer or you know what you're doing, because a lot of times people can get hurt, especially young kids who have never been in circus. And I always had my dad with me, so that was a different story. But when you're not from the business, I think it's very important to have somebody that can guide you through it. And so that way you're safe and you're not going to get hurt.
Justin, you say that because we had one of our guests on, this guy Salama Wabi, who's also a multi-generational, now his kids are multi-generational circus performers. But he was talking about how he feels like a lot of these super young programs like don't build a fundamental level of skill that is trying to give people an act that they can then go and do and perform at like middle school or whatever. And it's setting up young people for failure because they don't have a good
base.
Yeah.
Well, also, I had one question that I realized I never asked. But so your mom or your dad always are in your act, right?
Not always. No. I do need somebody that I can trust and somebody that travels with me to hand me the bow. In a long contract, I can find somebody on season that will, you know, I can train with them and have them do it. My family is just very close. Like it's either my brother, my dad, my mom. You know, we try to stay together as much as we can, as crazy as that sounds, because my brother's, you know, in one show, my dad's in another show, me and my mom are in the show, but we try to stay together as much as we can, and we're very family oriented.
That's so nice, because when your mom came out to give you the bow and arrow, Josh was like, that's her mom. I was like, that's so cute. I'm going to make you give me my bow and arrow when I learn to shoot it with my toes.
I will come out of the show.
The crossbow.
When I learned the crossbow.
You can't take a lane streak.
I got my manservant to give me my crossbow.
Going back to the foundation of tricks. So my dad likes to train other kids to do, he can train like basically any act because he likes to observe, you know, different skills, and it's amazing that he can see, you know, the teeter board act and watch the guy come out of the teeter board and he already knows if he's gonna land it or mm-hmm. not. Like he has this, I don't know. Like,
tell me what happens though, growing up in the circus and doing so many acts and seeing so many acts.
Yeah. So he's great at stuff like that. And I don't consider myself a good like teacher or trainer, but a lot of times people ask me for advice. My brother's a hand balancer, so he'll ask me for advice, but it's different because he's at kind of like a higher level. But for me to train someone from zero, that would be very hard for me because I don't really remember how to start. I do know how to, you know, stretch and stuff like that. So like the little girl in the show that's with us now, she's always stretching with me and doing splits and stuff like that. And I stretch with her. But I think that for someone to learn an act, it's important to have a lot of patience, and which is, that's something that is not really taught.
Mm-hmm.
It's just they go into doing tricks when, like for me, I spent a whole year practicing every day, 3 to 4 hours, just being on my hands. I wasn't allowed to do any trick. I was just resisting, like, how long can I stay on two hands? How long can I stay? And I would want to do one arm, like, so bad. And my dad was like, no, you're not taking your arm off until you can do, like, at least 3 minutes staying in two hands, like comfortable and not, you know, breathing heavily or not having your face turn red. So, and it's really boring. I mean, you know, it's horrible because you want to do, you know, you're excited to do more things. And then once I would do that, my dad's like, okay, now we're going to just do time on one arm. So you're just going to do right arm and then you're going to do left arm. And you're just going to stay as long as you know tricks. And it was the same for him, for his training with the slack rope. It's like, my grandfather used to be like, well, you're just going to walk, you know, just walk it. Just feel comfortable in it. And like sometimes my dad would be like, oh, yeah, but I'm thirsty. And he's like, okay, stay there. I'm going to bring you. I'll get you a drink. You're going to drink it up there. So it's a matter of just being comfortable with what you're doing first. And then everything else just comes so easy. And that's something that they don't.
Yeah, I think really, that patience is an amazing piece of advice as well.
Yeah. I was just imagining standing in a handstand for 3 minutes and how awful that
sounds. Do you know how long you can hold a regular handstand for at this point?
Now?
Have you tried? Yeah.
I haven't tried. Probably around 5 minutes with just two hands. Yeah. Probably like 5 minutes. I don't really know what condition I'm in right now because when you stop training something, like, it's...
Yeah, you got to work at it to keep it up.
Yeah, but I know I can do about 5 minutes.
We'll call the Guinness Book of World Records.
Yeah.
She can do it.
Yeah, I can do it.
Set the record. Okay, and our final question is, who do you think we should have on the podcast?
I think anybody in the show is very thrilled to be in a podcast, and there's very interesting stories. A lot of the cast that is in our show have been for generations. A lot of them have big names, like the Tuniziani family, you know, all the brothers.
Yeah, they're crazy.
I think that would be really fun to have
all three
brothers.
I was just thinking that, yeah.
Sitting here.
When we were there, he got the quad
flying,
and I was I'd never seen anyone nail it. We've seen people try it over and over and, like, never get it.
His
first try, too. It was so good.
It's such a difficult trick. I mean, it's so, and we all, like, you only get a couple tries. Like, you can't, even when he practices, he only gets like 3 or 4 because the catcher, you know, his legs start hurting and, you know, his arms start hurting. It's such a demanding trick, you know, that it's super exciting when he gets it. Everybody just screams in the backstage,
and you could tell on his face, he's like, yeah. And then Josh was like, I need a photo with him.
Yeah.
He's like, okay, fangirl. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. I mean, I love hearing anyone who's grown up in the circus because it's so vastly different than any reality I knew existed. Yeah. And so I think that's a good idea, especially if you have all three brothers.
Yeah.
And they all have families, so their kids are
so cute.
Yeah. So it's I think it'd be great to have them here.
Great. Elaine, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you guys for having me.
Thank you. And that was our interview with Elaine Kramer.
If you enjoyed today's episode, follow us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, Twitter, tweet us, write us an email at hello@hideawaycircus.com, subscribe on iTunes, and leave us a rating. Have a happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving!
Enjoy your turkey.